go.
This is table two, Asia speaking, date October 21st, 2023 at the Crispus Attucks Museum. And you're all set to go.
Just shuffle the cards.
Public art has had the biggest impact in Indianapolis.
Introduce yourself too.
My name is Rebecca Robinson. I'm a mixed media artist. I am an activist, a mentor, and I'm also heavily involved in the community of Indianapolis and building art and culture. City. So yeah, what type of public art has had the biggest impact in Indianapolis? I might be a little biased, so I'll let you know.
I'm going to toss out the murals. I think the murals have been really great talking points, especially the Mari Evans and the Etheridge Knight, which is the newest of the murals downtown. And it's, as someone who isn't born and raised in the city, but from the state, it's a way of like placing Black history physically in Indianapolis, and you know they're also strategically located, the murals, so it's also connecting individuals with specific spots and specific histories in the state. By the way, this is Walton Muyumba. I teach literature and creative writing at Indiana University of Bloomington, and I write creative nonfiction and cultural criticism.
Okay. I'm Joshua Ross, a visual artist. I practice photography and drawing. I'm from Indianapolis, and my family, for a couple of generations, has been raised on a street called Holmes off of 10th Street. And on Holmes, there are a couple sort of neighborhood stores. Like there's a restaurant that I was talking about with someone earlier named John's Fish Market that, you know, we would always sort of visit, but sort of adjacent that sort of restaurant is a barbershop that has always had like a painting on the wall that I just remember seeing, and I photographed with a friend walking through the neighborhood, and it wasn't the barbershop that I got my hair cut at growing up, but it's the only sort of representation of art that I remember always seeing and always kind of recognizing as sort of representing, you know, something that felt important. And I'm describing it in a way that I kind of felt about it, where I was like, oh, that's nice, you know, but I don't know if it was the portrait of the owner, or I think the way or the style that it was painted in kind of flatten a need for it to reflect a specific person, and more so just kind of was like a icon or sort of a figure that you would revere. Like it was painted in, it has like blue, which felt like the sort of sky as the background, and the people's sort of face was circled. So it just, it was something you could recognize as important, you know. So I guess murals, I second that. and for me, it was one on the side of a building.
Ryan, what's your
Rhonda Green, photographer based out of Indianapolis, born and raised from Indianapolis. I'm going to have to say with the 18 Collective, it just, for me, it was an introduction. Like I said, it's been a couple of years, although I've been shooting photography, just trying to connect with Indianapolis art scene. And so that was my, really, like, my first visual, like, okay, people are doing it out here, you know? Like, this is, there's more, I was hopeful of the growth. And so for me, it's a personal thing. It was just the ability to see, like I said, the growth. Because I travel other places, and it's like, why isn't Indianapolis standing out? We stood out. And now, look where we are. So for me, you don't have to be biased. Right. I'm going to go
for all our youngsters, they come in and go straight for the thing.
Girls, I think it's a reflection. It's almost a quilt.
Thank
of
you
so
all.
Many things that happen, you know, or that can occur in the city or part of someone's life, their emotional patterns.
Rebecca Robinson, mixed media artist. As far as the murals, even before the Black Lives Matter mural, there were murals for racial justice, and that came a couple months before. And, you know, during the pandemic, and people were under, you know, lockdown, quarantine. So when everything happened, you know, surrounding George Floyd, everybody was, you know, protesting, and, you know, when I physically went downtown Indianapolis and saw what happened, I was really, really saddened, and I just remember getting contacted by the Arts Council about creating something in support of the protest, and I ended up doing, and we didn't have a lot of time, so I did a mural titled New Nation, and it was to represent what I thought, you know, what this world could really look like, you know, just not in our city, just everyone uniting and protesting for a purpose. And it was a powerful piece, and I did a huge mural out of, you know, my preferred medium, concrete and tar, and it was a kneeling figure holding a flag, and the flag was all in black of the United States, and everyone coming together, you know, to symbolize that unity. And, you know, that was really significant for me. And one thing that I noticed that the murals allow people to have conversation and dialogue and ask questions. And, you know, everyone was tense during that time. But I believe the artwork, and I always say artwork, I say this a lot, artwork is a universal language. So I felt like the murals opened doors for more conversation and more artists that never even had a platform. And so kind of leading into the Black Lives Matter mural, that just, you know, took it to another level as well, because that was 17 other people that I knew, a few of them, and I was very close, and there were some artists I'd never met before, but I was like, wow, you know, there's so many talented, you know, people here in Indianapolis, and, you know, black folks specifically that didn't have opportunities or a voice, and that one moment allowed an artist to express how they felt about what was going on, you know, in our city and around the world. So I think the murals definitely are significant.
Hi, my name is Johnson Simon. I have a studio at the Hudson Center. I'm from Florida, and I'm also Haitian. The first art that captured my eye, I'm not from Indianapolis, but it was the meal of Reggie Miller on the wall. As an African American, seeing that image on that wall and as an artist on my own, you know what? This city appreciate who I am. Even as someone with a disability, there is hope that I could establish myself here. So seeing that image on that wall, it really gave me some type of comfort, because you could go around the city, you could see a lot of monuments, a whole bunch of patriots, you know, former people that were in the war, but you don't see no African-American sculpture. The only thing you could see is the one of Martin Luther King on the on 20th and cars, but you don't see. But I think that meal of Reggie Miller that was so big on the wall, it was like a bold statement that people like me have a place in this city. Yeah. Can you read it out loud for us? I'm going to pick it and you read it out loud.
Okay.
I'll pick that one.
All right. What forms of self-segregation exist today?
Will you repeat the question? All right.
I'm of a particular experience in this state because I grew up in Terre Haute and went to school at IU. I've lived in Virginia and Texas also.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that I would come into my middle decades, let's call them, self-segregating, but I noticed that I do it, and largely because I just don't want to deal with stuff, right? Like, I know my spots. You know, basketball players talk about where they go to get their points, right? I know my spots on the floor where I know I can get sustenance, where I'm going to have conversation, see art, game. But then I retreat because there are other spaces I don't want. I already have a sense that if I go there, it's going to cause consternation at the least. So I probably have lived in Indianapolis now since 2016. I bought a house basically like Meridian Kessler near Watson Park, just like 38th and College. And especially during the pandemic, that while everyone else was like, oh, I'm suffering being at home, I was like, this is great. Especially after Memorial Day of 2020, I was like, okay, safe zone. I'm just gonna stay inside this personal bubble. It's changed a little bit subsequent, you know, vaccination, but I do notice that I want to have art experiences, writing experiences that don't remind me of what is already ever present, which is the kind of physical and existential dangers of being in a black body and trying to be mobile. So I find myself resisting engaging in certain spaces where I know already that this is putting me at some kind of risk.
No, I can piggyback on that. Rebecca Robinson, mixed media artist. So I was thinking like on the artist side of it and self-segregation, it's like you fight so much to get into certain spaces and then you know, once you get in, it's like maybe you kind of go back to try to keep what's yours. So it's like this double-edged sword, like, please, 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 you know, allow us to shine, allow us to have a platform, allow us to have, you know, be in these spaces. And then after you get it, my personal experience is it exploitation. Are you using because you're going to get a little bit more money or kickback, or you get to check that box? So then I think you start feeling some kind of way, like, wow, are you really welcoming? So then the self-segregation comes where, you know, certain artists or African-American artists get together and say, hey, you know, maybe we need to lean back into, you know, our own again. But we just made a point. So it's always like making the point. We deserve to be in these spaces. We deserve to be able to have these opportunities. But then we still need to have our own.
I'm Joshua Ross, photographer and drawer. When I'm listening to y'all, I was trying to also define or figure out what self-segregation is or why would you self-segregate. So I think I'm kind of falling in like suit with some of what y'all are saying. And I also formed a question and a couple in terms of like what spaces are available to me, and why would I involve myself or keep myself in a space for self. And I guess I think about safety, you know, for me, like when I think about what spaces are available, when I go to a space, it's important that I feel safe. And when in Indianapolis, I think there's a sort of a limit or in spaces for creative people. They're really cultivating an environment where you have the opportunity to exchange and feel different and be sort of in different places while sort of sharing the same physical space. You know, I really love that I'm from Indianapolis because I love my family and I love that I do feel connected. Like, I know what's going on in the city. But I also feel that, you know, when I feel like in certain spaces I'm able to more comfortably express my the fullness of who I am, and in other spaces when that's expressed, I feel available to harm due to sort of the different values that people might have, and maybe how I perceive like being received or not being received. And so I always feel like when I go out, if I don't have that armor on, I get hurt. And when I do have the armor on, I'm not actually expressing myself in the way that I do when I'm within sort of a more sort of private community of friends that's smaller and more segregated in terms of like beliefs that and values. So what forms of self-segregation is this today? I guess that I feel like self-segregation to feel safe. Like, you know, it's like, and it makes me think about like, you know, like the original sort of prompt of like, that we all respond to like murals, and in those murals, there are always kind of historic figures. And I think that in this place, like, there is a relationship to time and values that are, I feel, are kind of dated. And I think that when I'm not sort of in this sort of form of self-segregation, it's because of my relationship to time. And having more progressive values. Progressive and like gender expression or being queer or not necessarily being religious in a very sort of religious state and conservative state.
Rhonda Green, photographer. I'd like to piggyback off of what Joshua said, about feeling safe. Especially for me, like I said, just kind of stepping out, exposing myself, looking for, as I mentioned, the welcoming committee, you know, where's the safe space? And I mean, I'm still kind of looking forward to, you know, today. I have this thing with discernment, you know, I want to walk into a room and we're not vibing. You know, I know how to step over to the side and chill and still be, you know, personable. But, you know, and sometimes I walk away disappointed because my expectations were more. You know, I'm thinking, you know, they're going to embrace me or this situation. And it's like, okay, I feel like I'm in a room of competition. And I'm just kind of wanting to be amongst artists, creatives, you know. Free thinkers in whatever way you think, you know, and so it's not always available, and so yeah, I'll pull back, and I don't want to always have to do that, but it is a protection, yeah.
Johnson Simon, I want to piggyback something that Rebecca said about it being a checkbox. As someone with a disability, also an artist, and also an African American, sometimes when I get opportunity, I also want to see what is the motive. Because I have been in a situation where it's for that game to be able to see, yeah, he have a disability. I gotta be, are you picking me based on my talent or are you picking me based on a tech bar? So I always got to be self-aware of that and be like, is it worth my time? So I'm always keeping my eyes, cause I want you to appreciate what I have to offer. And not just a chat box, or he got disability, and he's, you know, it's not fair. I want you to evaluate me for who I am, and for the gift and the potential that I have.
How do you feel, Johnson? This is Walton Muyumba. How do you feel about safety? Because of all of us at the table, you take the most risk daily, right? To whether it's like making your work or even coming to an event like this. Do you feel like the city is open to you? Do you feel like you have specific spots that you go to regularly where you're going to be sustained?
That's a good question. As someone that is from the South, where you see it could be very racist sometimes, it's not as welcoming. It's like a competition. Everybody is focused on themselves. From someone that, you know, that come from the South, and when I moved to the Midwest, I'm like, oh my goodness, you gonna open the door for me? Or people say, oh, Southern hospitality, but to me, when I was in the South, I have a whole different point of view because I feel like it's different when I did move to the Midwest. So one thing that I'm aware of is seeing the opportunity that I have in front of me, and also, and making sure it's genuine. like, I make, I'm always gonna, I always have to ask my people that know me and people that value me opinion, hey, do you think this is a good move for me? So I try to get feedback before I take something on. And talk to make sure it's the right move to do.
And Rhonda, this is Rebecca Robinson, mixed media artist, and I wanted to pose a question to you, Rhonda. And you mentioned something about discernment and, you know, just how you want to feel around other creatives or feel welcome. Can you give an example of what that would look like if, for you, where you would feel comfortable or you felt like you were welcome?
Today, this is Rhonda Green, photographer. Today, I honestly do. I mean, I think we all have our own way of thinking. I mean, I feel like there's a respect. I mean, I'm like, I follow you. Okay, these people are really important people. You know, these are established artists here in Indianapolis, and you've made me feel welcome. I don't feel, and so I appreciate that. So I would have to say today is a... I just felt like I had the opportunity to be myself.
I love that. Yeah. And I think that's so important to make people feel welcome, where they can have an opportunity to just, you know, be, like you said, in a safe space, feel valued. So let's say, you know, if you're new, even if you're around someone who's established or, you know, someone that's new to the game, it's just we're all in the same thing together, and you just want to build relationships. I think that is so important, to just build relationships. And when you leave here, then everyone needs to keep in contact or follow one another. And like I said, be a resource. And I mean that. You follow me, I will pass on whatever opportunities. I'll get to know what your goals are, what your ambitions are, the right people you need to meet and network with. Even just being in the same spaces. I always tell all, not just artists, creative people, I say, yeah, you might have a goal for your own art and what you want to accomplish, but support other artists. Show up. Find out who these people are. Recognize the person across the room. When I came in today, there's all kinds of people that I know. And you smile and you laugh and you talk. You're just happy to see a familiar face. So when I, you know, invite you to somewhere, I'm going to say, hey, Rhonda. Okay?
Yes.
So,
yes. I appreciate this.
You're
I
welcome.
Do.
Yes.
Much respect.
Cool.
Yeah. One thing I want, I'm Joshua Ross, a photographer and drawer. One thing I also, that's always in my mind in terms of, like, showing up is, like, you know, the way I survive here is different from the way I've survived in other places. And so I have a really, odd work schedule, like, because I work a second shift job. And so during the day, it's like, I have my mornings, which just worked out. And then my day, I'm, like, working. And then my studio hours are, like, really late. And so, you know, I'm always curious, and not to know, but I'm just more curious how, because I know we all navigate living and then being artists in different ways, and I think that we can sometimes be impacted in ways that people may never get awareness of, you know, and I think that that's something that I'm personally, like, I'm aware of for other people, but I feel like in my own personal life, I'm like, well, I don't want to tell everybody I'm always working. You know, it's like I actually just want to go to work and, like, you know, and not have people have to even think about that, you know. But then it's like a real thing that impacts my ability to form relationships with people, and, you know, and it's never, you know, and I mean, it's a case by case basis because, of course, like, you know, I would communicate, but. I just to reel it back in, I do really appreciate today, and I think that, you know, like, how we are able to kind of sit at a table is different because you get, it's more intimate, we're closer, and it's like we, you know, we're able to, like, nourish ourselves with one another, and like I said, like, it's not always, like, I'm always like, what spaces exist for us to be in communion, you know? It, that's my leg streaking the chair, but, but I mean, I'll let, no, can I be that comfortable? No, I'm just, no, it's my leg, but no, it's always, you know, I'm always thinking about how do artists get together and, like, share in an intimate way, you know, and not just a professional way, like, in a real, like, we, or having a drink or whatever, or having coffee. I feel like it just is more fertile for, like, you know, something to grow, you know.
Mixed media artist Rebecca Robinson, a lot of artists, you go to a lot of art related things and you talk about art, but there's so many other things that you do or your interests.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I'm like, sometimes I don't want to talk about painting all the time.
No, you don't.
I like doing other things. There's more to me. There's more layers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting. And that's what makes creative people mm-hmm. who they are. It's not just because you create beautiful artwork or photography or you write a beautiful piece. I'm pretty sure. Okay, so what's something about you that no one else? Yeah, we should ask everybody. Let's make up our own question. What's something about you that no one knows? Because you said you write.
This is Walton. My family's from Congo, Kinshasa. No, you wouldn't know that unless I said it, right?
See?
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Rhonda, what about you? What's something about you? You do photography for what else?
You can really put me on the spot. Something that no one knows about me. Okay, I think it's kind of crazy, but I know Chinese calligraphy. Learned it at the Children's Museum as a volunteer. Like, and so that, and Chinese medicine. So, yeah.
Mm. Joshua. Take your time.
Good question.
No judgment, son.
No, I'm not afraid of being judged. I just think it's hard because I'm an open book, but I also don't just openly share, like, all the time because I'm quiet. So I'm like, there's a lot that people don't know. What might... Oh, well, this is fun. My first job was, I was employed by my social studies teacher who had a Doc Henderson's fish market, and I would work at the hot dog stand on the circle downtown, and then on the weekends I would work in his fish market. I don't know. I'm like, that was my first job.
That's a good question, because I'm like an open book. But the one thing that people might not know, I think I do tell people I'm Haitian, but they don't really think I'm bilingual until I start, if my mom called me and I start freaking Creole, they're like, oh, what? You speak Creole? I'm like, yeah, I'm Haitian. So I'm a free Creole fluent in my first language. So when I start speaking Creole, there, are you okay? I'm a freaking Creole. Yeah.
Let's see. So one thing people might not know about me, I didn't mention that I ride a motorcycle, so a lot of people don't think I did that. But I'm really mischievous. Like, oh, I've always been a mischievous kid.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let's see. Well, I went to Montessori school from the age of, like, 2 or 3 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
And they want you to be individuals and free spirits and all that. I'm the same person as I was at the age 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. The same person. I've always just been kind of bad. In a sarcastic, fun way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have some sins. But I like to get into a little stuff. So.
Play. Yeah.
Yeah, I like to play. That's cool.
Yeah. I was looking up, this is Walton again, I was looking up this quotation from Adrian Piper that goes to what you were saying, Joshua, about the work that I think artists do to try to explain themselves. And she says here that artists ought to be writing about what they do, what kinds of procedures they go through to realize a work, what their presuppositions in making the work are, and related things. If artists' intentions and ideas were more accessible to the general public, I think it might break down some of the barriers of misunderstanding between the art world and artists and the general public. I think it would become clear the extent to which artists are just as much a product of their society as anyone else, as in any other kinds of vocation. And I think part of what's built into that is also, like, in fact, talking to people about, like, what your life actually entails to make the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's also invisible, right? Not everyone can snap a photo and make it into art.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can, sketch or see natural material and manipulate it into something that is meaningful, right? And, you know, I think when students ask me, well, you know, I have this vision of wanting to, you know, have a life as an artist, but I really don't want to have to, like, labor at it. I'm like, well, you're in trouble.
Right.
Right? It's like, you know, this, all of it is work, right? Even like, yeah, I have a second shift job so that I make time to make art. Like, that doesn't occur to most people as the route to having an artist's life. So I think that's one of the things I've learned about my own work is also that not just to talk about what I'm doing or trying to do, but also to ask a lot of questions about how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I'm thinking about, like, shaping out an essay, I'm always thinking about form, so I'm asking questions to writers and non-writers and to other kinds of artists, like, you know, how do you imagine the narrative of yourself? What's the shape? Could you describe the shape in a manner that is recognizable to someone else? So that, you know, you're trying to, like, communicate why you're making the choices you're making. What's that form, right? But the response is always then filter into the thing that I'm trying to do. I just see that as part of that motion. I mean, we began by talking about segregation, self-segregation, and what I find interesting about the question is that it doesn't really have space for what self-segregation actually might do that is powerful. Because you can segregate into particular communities, your spots again, where you're fed so richly that you don't want to engage in other kinds of things, right? And there's always going to be some necessary retreat to make, right? You can't be hanging out with your people if you have deadlines, you know.
Yeah. Oh boy. Okay.
Somebody please. Cards.
I love cards.
Game of Uno, that's about it.
I'll get really competitive about Uno. Alright. Let's see what we can draw. Okay. Okay, I'm Joshua Ross. a photographer and drawer. And the card I pulled asks, how can we engage with the historical artwork displayed in this exhibit without perpetuating the spectacle of lynching?
This is the Dana Schutz question. Well, I mean, I think about this question a lot, right? Because this is Walton. So Dana Schutz, I went to the Whitney Biennial when Dana Schutz's rendering of Emmett Till was in the show. I'm actually writing an essay about it because, in fact, I went to that show twice, maybe three times actually, went all the way through, and I never saw that painting. I was so excited by many of the other pieces that were up. Henry Taylor, Dina Lawson, Lyle Ashton Harris. I mean, there was just like over an abundance of really brilliant work. So when the controversy about that painting came up, and Schutz attempted to use abstract techniques to render Till, and it's, you know, she's trying to like reference the Jet magazine photograph of his face, and it looks like a kind of swirl of color, a smear of color. And I'm not sure that the image itself was successful, but many black artists felt that Schutz, who happens to be white, had not only overstepped in trying to take on the material, but because the rendering did not do the work they imagined of humanizing Till, and essentially, you know, maintaining the kind of sacredness of not simply the photographs of Till, but the whole event of his killing and the sacrifice his mother made to make sure that the world saw what they did to his son. I got the protests, and I understood why they may want that piece to have been withdrawn. But what's interesting is that there's a whole tradition of African-American art making, engaging not simply with Till, but with lynching generally, either absolute realist or highly metaphorical. In fact, there's a rendering in this exhibition of his name escaping me, I can totally see his face, Jacob Lawrence. And that's metaphorical, right? That you see a noose hanging from the branch, see the back of a figure. There isn't an immediate connection between the figure and the noose as such, although there is a mournful quality present. And then, which is one kind of version of engaging. Another kind is what Kara Walker has been doing in her silhouettes for umpteen years. And then even grander exhibitions like the Sugar Street that she did in the Domino Sugar Factory in New York City. And I think we cannot limit ourselves as artists or other artists in how they want to approach the subject matter. And it is, I think, necessarily going to be painful, right? Because that history is not a history we're trained socially and culturally to reckon with in a manner that has been healthy historically, right? So I'm not sure we can avoid a certain amount of perpetuation of pain. But I think the difference, say, between Schutz and Lawrence and Walker is that what Lawrence and Walker are doing as members of the large black family, if you will, what they're trying to do is, I think, dwell on the deep human realities built into that, and always humanizing the black subjects in their work, and even in terms of, you know, what Walker does with, say, satire or the grotesque, is super important because no one escapes the scope of her ironic gestures, right? So just as if you imagine that you're somehow outside of that field, I'm always struck there's always some child figure, especially in her silhouettes, who's cutting someone's head off, right? Like, no one is innocent in this. Like, violence begets violence. So I'm not sure that we can escape it. I think we ought to engage it and deal with what it means to, like, bring that history, that painful history, and put it in the public. But it's a necessary act.
That's a pretty
good question. Yeah. I would love to jump into this because this is, I think this question is at the core of, like, my sort of drive as an artist. Like, so I'm Joshua Ross, photographer, drawer. I think I definitely want to mention, like, sort of, like, this, like, specific spectacle of lynching. I just want to mention it. And then I definitely want to talk about this sort of recent sort of incident of, I don't know, violence that on display, like, that was traumatic to a large number of people, and how, like, it's a recurring sort of, you know, it's perpetuated, like, across history and time, you know, violence against black people. Well, my phone is vibrating, so it's distracting me from thinking. But one thing that I'm, like, I really love that you mentioned all of these people that we could have focused on in this moment. And I also think that, like, so I was thinking about, like, recognizing, like, historic violence for what and when it was, what it is, when it was, who did it, what their sort of relationship was to the violence. And then I also think, like, in sort of the presence of an event like this, it's important to say everything that is happening and taking place. What I think was really frustrating for me personally is that the distribution of sort of importance became focused on Dana Schutz when it was not about Dana Schutz at all. And so I really appreciate the words you used to describe how she painted the work. And one word that stood out to me was that she smeared. Like, it was smeared. So I think that these are opportunities for our writers, our thinkers, to really talk about the actions that are happening and not necessarily sort of become so triggered by the event that we forget to write it into history the way it occurs. Because it's like, we could talk about all of what, I didn't see the show in person. I have memory of the artists who were involved. I wish I had the opportunity to go. But for me, yes, I would want to talk about Dana Schutz and that she decided to this day, smear a black face. And then there's the sassy part of me that responds, and I'm like, ignore the abstraction, you know? And so I think there are ways that we can sort of mark her in relationship to all of these other people in the way that she decided to show up in the space, which is in the manner of her, you know, like she kept in line with her practice of sort of, I mean, I'm not even versed in her work, but let's just say her smearing technique, and she thought it was appropriate to render like a historic subject that was mutilated in the manner like that perpetuates like the violence. And when you are versed in sort of material approaches to utilizing material, then I think it's our responsibility to understand how that material is sort of exists within a visual lexicon, you know. And it's like, I just think there's so much more power we have in sort of like, not just she did this thing, but like, let's just talk about in a more frank way what she did and move along, because it should not be the sort of, it shouldn't, I hate that it's the memory of like a moment that was bigger than her. And I also really, I guess I get a little sort of perverse pleasure in knowing that this is still what you chose to do. Like, and that's how I'm willing to recognize your relationship to me. And that means that we still have more work to do, but like my focus is not on her. Like, you know, it's like, I'm glad to know that everything is not a lie that I'm telling myself, that you can still dehumanize this person, like that you still don't find any urgency within yourself to sort of relate to this subject in a different manner. I don't know, I get frustrated that we don't really take the power that we have in moments like this, and real empowering that, like, we, I hated to see like bodies like in front of that, like in sort of resistance, because it just felt like it was an opportunity for us to celebrate. And so it just felt like, for me, that was a form of lynching, that people were bodies were still controlled by a controversial act done by a white body. So that was the violence to me. And that is how I felt lynching was perpetuated, that I had to watch black bodies resist a painting. Like, so I'm like, wow. Like, we have, this object has so much power over us.
Real quick, and I'll get out of the way. This is Walton again. I think the thing that you're pointing to, which is really crucial, is that there were not people of color. Because I actually think that when people are of color are present within institutions or within the critical system, that they halt some of that, right? So the curators from the Whitney who went to Schutz's gallery, or not gallery, but studio to look at work, and saw that piece, did not say no. They said, oh yeah, sure, right? But I bet that had there been among the curators an indigenous person, a Mexican American, an Asian American, they would have said, wait a second, right? And so this is one of those places where representation is crucial. But then in the critical community, right, all the people who went to go see the previews of that show, there weren't really black critics or critics of color present to be like, wait a second, how are you going to put this up here? And then around the corner is Times Ain't Changing Fast Enough by Henry Taylor, right? Right around the corner. I mean, the brilliance of the Taylor painting is that it's all about humanizing Philando Castile, right? It's at the moment of intense traumatization, and yet the pose of the body is about the simultaneous resistance and strength, you put that against the Schutz painting, and it's like any critic, and I'm totally untrained, you know, I don't have the deep art historical background to walk in, but any critic can walk into that space who has a background as an ethnic American person and be like, there's a problem there, right? And so I think that what you're saying is just is so deep and rich given this question, because it points out, again, we need to be present in certain spaces, but it's at risk, right?
And I'm glad you mentioned being present, because a couple of years ago, I was asked to sit on, Rebecca Robinson, I was asked to sit on the planning committee for the Emmett Till traveling exhibit for the Children's Museum. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy to be a part of that, to see exactly how it was going to be executed, what the intent was, the look of the, you know. So it even got to the point where, before they even opened the doors to the public, I was, myself and several of us, you know, got to walk through. And there was one section, there was a video, kind of like a mini documentary, and I kind of sat in the back, and they had a few, I think it was a few young kids, I think the exhibit had to be 10 and up, and I sat there and I watched, and I was just in tears, and one of the other coordinators walked up to me, and they were like, Rebecca, are you okay? And I was just like, it was just really, really difficult to watch, and I said, I'm really concerned about, you know, this is the Children's Museum. These are parents bringing their children to see this. Is there a certain age? Is there a certain time to show this type of content? If it made me feel that way. And I think there was a kid sitting in front of me. He looked to be about 12. And he was asking significant questions. And it made me feel a little better that he was aware. He paid attention to what he was watching. And I believe, I'm not sure, but I think the Children's Museum had it where when you left, you had a little bit of support. Maybe you could talk to someone or ask more questions and things like that. But I think that being uncomfortable allows vulnerability. And when you're vulnerable, you're a little bit more open. And maybe that will allow you to understand. So I don't think there's any way to avoid it. There's no way to avoid it. So even something, when it's controversial or triggering, so what at this point? It is what it is. And someone, like you said, you need to be in the room, you, mm-hmm. myself. And it needs to be a balance there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. You can't have other people telling our history or explaining. You know, you can read all you want. You can be the biggest researcher, and you've done all your, you know, you've traveled here and there. But the people who live it every day, and lynching, sometimes people just equate that with, oh, someone being, you know, hanged and things like that. Lynching is across the board. It's so diverse when it comes to what lynching. What is the definition of lynching? What is that?
We were talking about this earlier, that this is Walton. The history of lynching in the U.S. is fascinating, because at least one work that I've read presents it as the beginning of modern 20th century America. That sometimes there wouldn't even be a victim. They would start announcing the gathering via radio or telegraph or telephone, to gather people together, and then they would figure out who they were going to kill, right? And I just was watching the new documentary by the Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck about, it's called Silver Dollar Road. It's on Amazon. I just saw it last weekend in Chicago at the film festival up there, and it's a brilliant piece about a family trying to maintain control of a piece of land of theirs in North Carolina. But the contemporary problem is connected to the history of African American land ownership and all the layers of trickery and terrorism that post Reconstruction white citizens in the South used to like steal land from black farmers and landowners. And one of the things that Peck does is he has a sequence where he's presenting basically news clippings from papers, including one, I had to stop the movie watching it for a second time last night, because one of the news clippings say 15,000 show up for lynching, right? That's like 15,000 people going to see a basketball game, right? So that was Saturday Night Entertainment.
Wow.
Right? That's not like, oh, somebody did something, we had to go get them. That's like, they're planning like social events around maiming and killing people, right? So there is no escaping the pain, right? And also, there must be a realization that this isn't irrational mob violence. This is planned social events with violence at the center, right? A way of like perpetuating and maintaining specific forms of empowerment.
Control.
Yeah. And control, right? So I think that's also embedded in it, right? And I think a 12-year-old, a smart 12-year-old, is sitting watching that and saying, that's not happening accidentally. Mm-hmm. And putting things together and saying, okay, someone explain how this is going to have, this went on so long, and nobody, in most cases, were being arrested for it.
I would love to talk to that 12-year-old today. Like, how they recall what they saw, you know, on that screen. I mean, I was back there boo-hooing. And they even asked, do you think it's a little too much, or do you think we need to change this or change it? Leave it as it is at this point. This is just how it affected me. But I don't think I don't know if I even went back to see. I had seen enough. So I didn't need the exhibit personally. I think it's great that the Children's Museum did that, and it became, you know, this traveling exhibit. For me, I got to see what I needed to see, and I was done with it.
Back to self-segregation, right?
Right. You got to protect yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
That's hard. That's difficult. That's a challenge. And having to deal with it every day, not just a corner, you know, where you have a display, a gallery, a museum, but every day you're dealing with, you know, these issues or answering questions or trying to explain something or microaggressions, and you get accustomed, which is horrible. That's horrible that you get, I guess, immune to it. You shouldn't have to live like that. I guess our time is wrapping up, so this was great. I enjoyed it. I'm glad I decided to sit at table two.
Yes. My mom just keep going.
Keep going.
I'm thinking about so many other things.
Jamaican food.
I'm going to keep eating it. I'll have it. I'm not going to.
It's a lot.
That was a lot. I feel like there's so much to be said. Like, so much stuff keeps coming up.
This would have been a really good one. Discuss support systems for your art practice.
Thank you.
This was great.
That was great. So, sorry to interrupt, but I think I got you on a good transition.
See, it was meant for me to see.
Yeah. Great. I'm so happy to hear that. So I'm just going to stop your recording.